Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is writer Gail Jarrow. Jarrow is the author of many nonfiction books and novels for children and young adults age 8 to 18. She has just published the third in her Deadly Diseases trilogy, which focus on disease in the United States in the 20th century. The new book is called Bubonic Panic: When Plague Invaded America. It was published by Calkins Creek in May of this year. Jarrow is a graduate of Duke University and Dartmouth College and spent many years teaching science, math, and writing to students of all ages before becoming a professional writer. And welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me to come on.
Yeah, good to see you again. So the new book, Bubonic Panic, is your third nonfiction title in this trilogy about 20th century diseases. How do you decide what kids would be interested in reading and whether it's too heavy for them?
This one was really easy because everybody is fascinated by plague. Kids love it. It is a disgusting, horrible disease. Many fatalities. Everybody knows about the Black Death. Yeah. It also involves rats. I mean, these are all things that kids like because it's gross. So to come up with this idea was not difficult.
Yeah, I didn't even think about the grossness in rats and how kids are fascinated by that. Mm-hmm. Actually, I was too. So this was called the Black Death, the Great Mortality. And I mean, tell us about the several kinds of plague that are out there, could be out there, were out there. I didn't know about this.
Well, there's only one kind of plague, and it's caused by one kind of bacteria, but it can manifest itself in three different ways in the human body. The one is what we call bubonic, and that's because the victim develops buboes, which are swellings of the lymph nodes, and that is the most common type. And also the least fatal type. Then there's septicemic plague, and that's when the plague bacteria get into the bloodstream. And before antibiotics, that was almost 100% fatal.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
And then there's pneumonic plague. That is when the plague bacteria get into the lungs, and that is almost 100% fatal also before antibiotics. Pneumonic plague is the only kind that humans can transmit to each other.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the thing that scared so many people, right? I mean, they kept wondering how it was transferred.
They didn't know. In 1900, they didn't know. They had found the bacteria in 1894. They identified it, but they did not understand how the disease was transmitted to humans. They didn't completely understand how rats and fleas were involved. So they were in the dark.
Yeah. And what you talk in the book about the first recorded cases happened in the year 542, and people thought it was coming from God and the planets. Mm-hmm. And that fascinates me, that superstition around disease.
Well,
and it makes sense.
Don't we have superstitions about everything that we don't understand?
Yeah, absolutely.
And you can imagine when that happened, how horrible it must have been. I mean, you have 10,000 people a day dying in Constantinople.
Yeah.
Wow.
And they're gross deaths, too,
yeah,
most of these.
Really, yeah. Horrible suffering. You just try to imagine how people reacted to that when they had no understanding of disease, really. The chances are that there was plague before that, but who knows?
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
just no way to be sure.
But you talk about in the book that it did go dormant for 100 years.
It seemed
after that.
As
far as we know.
The problem that I discovered by reading about this is the records aren't there. How do you find out what happened 1,000 years ago?
Yeah.
We just don't know. People didn't keep the same kind of records. They didn't discuss diseases the same way that we do now. They didn't understand diseases. It's very difficult to know what was going on with plague.
So as far as we know, it went dormant, and the second pandemic came in the 14th century, and that's when people
Black
were starting
Death.
To... Yeah.
That was the huge Black Death event, which was like a 7-year period. There's different estimates, but from a quarter to half the population of Europe died.
It's unbelievable, I know.
And it created a huge change in the culture and governments. I mean, you have villages completely wiped out. You had villages that were, you know, a fraction of their size. The population, the workforce was much diminished. It had a huge economic effect.
Oh, yeah. I often wonder,
all these people wiped out in certain eras, how much we've missed of their expertise, their intellect.
Yes.
You know, what has been missing now from our body of knowledge because of this?
I know.
Oh, it just kills me when I think about all
this. I know.
It continues, you know, genocide, all those things I wonder about.
And then we have to relearn, or we don't learn everything that they knew.
The secrets are buried with them.
Yes.
So let's talk about the third pandemic, which began in the mid-1850s in China, because that's almost modern times compared to the rest. Scientists like Louis Pasteur were starting to figure out germ theory. And to talk to us a little bit about that one, though, the third one, they had more information. A little bit.
And it was because of the beginning of germ theory that there were bacteriologists who were trained to look for these causes of disease, and they had found them in bacteria. So when plague broke out in China, you had a number of these scientists go and look for plague's cause. And one of them was Yersin, who was French. He is the one who is credited with discovering the true cause of plague. And he did it in Hong Kong in 1894. He did it very quickly. I mean, within a week or two, he was able to find plague victims. They were Chinese. The Chinese did not want autopsies, but the British were controlling Hong Kong, and there were people that died. And he was able to get access to a body. And he took samples from a bubo where he thought he would probably find the bacteria. And he took it back to his makeshift lab, and he injected animals with it, and they developed the symptoms of plague, and then he examined their bodies, and he found the same bacteria, and that is why he thought he had found it. And it is proven that he did find it.
Yeah. And I'm sure nobody believed him, just like in ensuing years.
There was a Japanese scientist also working in Hong Kong at the time, and he claimed to have found it. Over the years, though, it was realized that what he identified as the plague bacterium was not actually the right thing, because they had not, when they identified them and they described them, Yersin's was different from his. Eventually, Yersin got credit, but there was a period of time when Yersin did not get credit. So now we call it Yersinia pestis. That is the name of the bacterium that causes plague.
How can you imagine being named after the plague?
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's an honor in medicine. Yeah. Now, the U.S. history, the first plague victim happened in Hawaii, right, in Chinatown in Hawaii in 1899, 1900. Talk to us about that. That was a huge controversy.
Hawaii was not a state then, of course.
Yes.
It was a territory. And plague did break out in Chinatown. They didn't know what to do. I mean, this is still early. It's only the fifth year after it was found in Hong Kong. But it was because it had broken out in Hong Kong, which was a shipping center. All these ships were going all around the world from Hong Kong, and presumably they were carrying rats that were infected, and that's how it spread around the world. But it got to Hawaii, probably that way. And the Chinatown area was near the harbor, probably the reason that's where plague showed up. At that time, they were very wrapped up into the idea of we have to disinfect everything.
Yeah.
And that's what they wanted to do. And one of the ways to do that, which is interesting because it's exactly what they did in the 14th century, was to burn anything that was infected.
Yeah.
So if they found a house that was infected, burn it down. That'll get rid of the bacteria. Well, unfortunately, one time when they tried to burn down an area of Chinatown in Honolulu, a wind came up and the fire got completely out of control and it burned Chinatown.
Yeah.
And all these people were homeless.
God, it's amazing. Amazing story.
And I think because of that, the Chinese in Chinatown, of course, thought this was done. It was an excuse to wipe them out, wipe out their community. Mm-hmm. And when plague showed up in San Francisco's Chinatown, the people had the same reaction because they just had seen what had happened in Chinatown, Honolulu. They thought, they're going to do the same thing to us.
I was going to bring up the plague in Chinatown in San Francisco. They tried quarantining Chinatown, too.
Yes.
And that was a huge controversy, too. That was a lot of racism was happening in San Francisco at that time.
Well, they also tried the quarantine in Honolulu because they didn't want anybody to go out. Again, it's thinking that people were transmitting it on their bodies. Yeah, so people in Honolulu that had servants that lived in Chinatown wanted them to come and work. They made the residents of Chinatown wash in public showers, and they were watched by health officials to make sure they did a good job. Then they were allowed to leave. So they had a quarantine as well. And then the quarantine was used in San Francisco, again, based on the same idea that there's something going on with the people that live in Chinatown, and they have this, and we don't want them to spread it to the rest of the city, so we're going to prevent them from leaving.
Yeah. And you know, racism was involved, too. They were thinking it was a Chinese.
Well, and it had broken.
Of course, there were other ones found later in other communities. But yeah.
Well, it had broken out originally in China, the third pandemic.
Exactly.
So when I read history, I try to think about the mindset of people, and sometimes, though we look back at it and say, oh, that was horrible what they did, you can almost understand why they would jump to conclusions that they did.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And you can flame fires like that. You know, any politician that stands up and says, yes, I mean, we see it today. Now the interesting thing in San Francisco that I didn't know about was that they did try to hide this, you know, from the newspapers so that they wouldn't lose business in San Francisco, right?
Yes, the health department and the U.S. Public Health Service recognized they had a problem, but the businesses certainly did not want the news to get out, because who would want to come to San Francisco if they found this out? Plus, it could hurt their trade. Who would want a ship from San Francisco to come to their port, or goods from San Francisco to go on trains to other parts of the United States? There was really this effort to deny that it was a problem. And again, looking back, maybe these people genuinely didn't believe it.
Yeah.
But certainly it wasn't in their interest to have plague in the city. So initially there was this fight to keep it quiet. And the governor of California went as far as accusing the public health service doctor of planting plague and fudging his data. He basically called him a liar, and it was ugly.
Yeah, yeah. And this was around the time when we had our first Surgeon General appointed, right? I mean, that's who you're talking about, right?
No, the Surgeon General was Walter Wyman, and he had been in office for a while, a dozen years or more.
Uh-huh.
I'm talking about Joseph Kenyon, who was the quarantine officer in San Francisco at the port. But this guy had a lot of experience. He had studied with Pasteur. He really knew his stuff. And he set up the first hygienic laboratory that the United States had. So he was put there because plague was a big issue. China had it. All those ships were coming from Asia into San Francisco. And he was really the point man on dealing with this plague. So he's the guy that took the hit from the governor and all the business and politicians.
I was surprised in your book how many careers were ruined because of this, because of the fear and the politics. And it sounds like we've come full circle, right?
Well,
you must have seen the parallel.
Oh, always. There's always a parallel. And it's the unknown. Nobody knew what to do for sure. Even the health service didn't know for sure what to do, and in fact didn't do the right things.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Gail Jarrow. We're talking about her new book, Bubonic Panic, When Plague Invaded America. It was just published last month. Now tell us how you do the research for these books. There's got to be, and you have extensive illustrations in these books. They're absolutely beautiful books. Where do you find this information and get, you know, permission to use photos and stuff like this?
Well, first on the permission to use photos, they are, most of them, out of copyright because they're so old. Also, many of them are from the government. So those are free to use. I have images of newspaper headlines, but from newspapers that are not even in existence anymore. So that's how I got around that. In terms of the general information, I try to use primary source material as much as possible, and there was quite a bit. The U.S. Public Health Service has records of all the telegrams sent back and forth from San Francisco to Washington and to the Surgeon General. That was just a wonderful source of information because I could see what was going on, how they were dealing with problems. Reading newspaper articles, I could find out the other side you know, what the public's being told. And there was a lot of bias. The newspapers were actually trying to suppress what was going on.
Oh, God, amazing.
So at one point, Kenyon, who was with the Public Health Service, sent a telegram back to the Surgeon General saying the people in San Francisco do not have a clue of how dangerous this is because the newspapers are not telling them the truth.
God, and then... That just amazes me because it's so parallel to what's happening in my lifetime and up to this moment, right?
This is when you study history, you cannot help but see parallels.
Yeah.
Things don't change.
Did you talk to any medical people? I mean, have any modern doctors dealt with the plague?
Well,
very few, probably.
Of course, it's not a problem really in this country. Doctors know about it. There have been some recent cases, like last summer, where in the West, where people have gotten plague, and doctors that work out there, practice out there, I think are aware of the symptoms, and they look for it. I talked to a CDC expert on plague. He's based in Colorado and doing research on animals. I mean, you know, he's not really studying humans because it's not a big thing.
Yeah.
However, he did get involved in an investigation of a 16-year-old in Colorado that died. And after his death, they realized he had had plague. The CDC got involved because they wanted to find out where did he get it. So this guy was involved in that. That's the kind of stuff he does.
Yeah. So what places in the world do they still see plague?
The most cases today are in Africa. I have a Google alert on this subject, and it's something that periodically you just get a lot of news articles. So Madagascar had a huge outbreak. It even got into urban areas. In Africa, it's most common in rural areas because people are living close to rodents.
Mm-hmm.
They're living close to grain, their food sources. The sanitation isn't wonderful in that it encourages rats and therefore fleas.
Oh, yeah.
So that is where you see most of these cases. But then if it gets into an urban area, you know, it can really spread if there's not controls.
Yeah.
And the other problem is many of these countries have very weak healthcare systems.
Oh, yeah.
So if somebody gets sick, it's not going to be diagnosed. And if plague is not diagnosed quickly, there's nothing that can be done. I mean, now we have antibiotics that fight it since the 1950s, but you have to be diagnosed with it first.
Yeah, or else it will still kill.
Yes.
And we forgot to mention that a vaccine was created for this.
There was a
way back when.
Yeah, there was a vaccine. It wasn't perfect, but it probably helped reduce deaths, and it produced, you know, it helped prevent people from getting sick or getting as sick, and that was used early in the 1900s. But
is it still used?
No.
Oh. Even if there was an outbreak, they wouldn't go.
Well, apparently no.
I
asked the expert about this, and he said there's no commercially available vaccine.
Hmm.
I guess they feel that there's nothing that's really real perfect about the vaccine at this point.
Yeah.
But there's research being done because it would be good to have it. Certainly, there's a question of bioterrorism.
I was going to bring that up next. Yes.
And that would be why it would be good to have a vaccine. So I think there is research being done.
Yeah. Did you look into the bioterrorism? I mean, where is this? This stuff has got to be being stored somewhere for people to fear bioterrorism, right? For research purposes,
yes,
supposedly?
Yes, there's definitely that. But it maybe isn't so hard to find it in the wild if you wanted to.
Yeah, I know, because a lot of people just think rats get it, but no, other animals, squirrels, all kinds of.
Well, last week, I mentioned I have a Google alert. So last week, there was a news story from Flagstaff, Arizona. And a jogger who ran a trail right behind where there's a lot of hotels happened to notice that the prairie dogs that he always saw had disappeared. And he told the authorities. They went in and they tested fleas in these prairie dog burrows, and there was plague. It probably killed off the prairie dogs.
Wow.
So they had to put up a warning on this trail and public announcement that there's plague. And an animal on here might have it. The fleas are infected, so be careful or stay away from it. This is going on. I mean, this is not something that disappears.
Yeah.
And people that live out west need to know and be careful.
Yeah, it's hidden in plain sight, I'm sure, in some of these areas, you know.
It's in the wild population of prairie dogs and ground squirrels. It doesn't come into the human population very often. I think the United States, according to the CDC, averages 7 cases a year, but it changes. Sometimes it's many more.
That's remarkable, considering that it really has to be diagnosed. And I'm sure a lot of physicians, modern physicians, have never even seen it and have no idea what, you know, what it looks like. Because it couldn't look like flu, right?
Yes. One of the things I say in the book, and this is the advice that the CDC gives, is that if you live in the West and you get any of these symptoms, it would be very helpful to the doctor to say, oh, I was hiking and I might have been exposed. People don't think about this, but they should.
People think of plague as a, you know, from the medieval times.
Yes.
In many cases. Did you run into any surprises when you were researching this book? I know you've continuously researched books about disease, but anything about this that surprised you?
Well, I was surprised, too, that it's still around. I guess that was one thing. I was surprised a little bit at how people reacted, how the government reacted, how business, how leaders reacted when it came in 1900. And I shouldn't have been surprised, but
I was. I was, because I was thinking, whoa, you know, that's almost sophisticated to think that they can actually even think in those terms to me, you know, instead of just a panic coming, you know, everybody blabbing about it.
Well, I think that one of the reasons plague did not take off in this country, and there really haven't, even since 1900, been so many deaths, is because the Public Health Service, now the CDC, they know what to do, and they have handled these problems, and they monitor. And there's all these controls at ports. They're controlling for rats coming in.
Yeah.
They're testing for fleas. If they see die-offs of prairie dogs, ground squirrels, they test. It's vigilance that's probably keeping things under control.
As we've seen, though, the CDC and some of the public officials can make major mistakes, as in the case of Ebola and, you know, panic. And then the Zika virus now, I mean, God knows where that's going to end up going with panic.
And that's something also that I've learned researching these diseases. When they first begin and nobody knows anything or very little, I think the medical people are super cautious. You don't want to be on the wrong side of this.
Yeah.
So, yes, there are going to be mistakes made that are on the cautious side until they gather more information.
Yeah, and you don't want to panic people. I mean, that's the bottom line.
You don't want to panic people, but you also don't want people to be careless. You want people to use good judgment.
Yeah. And people have to remember that we are still biological specimens, even if we have made great strides in medicine and eradicating disease. Every time I read one of your books, I think, my God, you know, I mean, we're still susceptible to all this stuff.
Yeah, to little teeny bacteria. That's right.
You know what I want to ask you, too? You've written all these books in there for children and young adults. Do you go into the classrooms and see the reactions of kids and talk to them about
this? I do talk to kids about these diseases, and they don't really know very much about them. So it is kind of fun to watch them realize, oh, wow, I didn't know that. So that's a rewarding thing, and that's why I write for the age group that I do. I write for 10 through high school, age 10 through high school. And it's because that's the age where kids are really absorbing a lot of information, things they didn't know before. And I'm hoping that not only do I give them information, but I help them to see the world in a different way, broaden their view. And I truly believe that history repeats, that if you have a knowledge of what happened in the past, it can help guide you into making good decisions in the future, because history is the action of people, and people are the same through the ages.
Yeah, we are. We are, absolutely. Did you ever interview anybody who had relatives who had had this disease in the olden days, or did you meet any elders?
Not plague, but the first book in the trilogy was about pellagra.
Mm.
And I did, after the book came out, I did have people send me emails and say, oh, you know what, I had a relative that had this, and tell me about it. And I kind of enjoyed finding out about that disease, which really was a problem in the first part of the 20th century. So that's not ancient history. And there were people who have family members that they personally knew that suffered from that disease.
Yeah.
And that's a forgotten disease.
Yeah. I mean, all these diseases, I hadn't thought about any of these until I had you on the show and we started talking about these.
Sorry.
So tell me, I mean, in sort of in a wrap-up idea of this book, what do you think we can learn from this history that we might have forgotten?
On plague in particular?
Yeah, plague in particular, yeah.
I think we should respect how science can be slow at coming to answers. Really good scientists are methodical, and they don't jump to conclusions, and they want to test things out. And that is what happened with plague. It took a long time until there was enough evidence to make conclusions. On the other hand, there were discoveries that were not accepted and brought into use for a decade, and people died because of that. When I read the news about diseases like Zika, you know, I'm aware of this, and I think about it. I think about we don't know anything about this disease, really.
Yeah.
They're in the process of learning more. There are going to be a lot of questions. There are going to be a lot of people that come out and say, oh, this is true, and this is true, and this is true, and I'm going to be waiting to be sure that's true before
anything medical. Look at all these retractions on female hormones and, you know, almost everything, some vaccines and some, you know.
Yes.
So, you know, information is continuously being gathered.
Yeah, and I think that is a lesson.
At your peril, you know, decide what's best for yourself.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's got to be hard for a practicing doctor.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yes, and a practicing human being.
Yes.
Now, have you been surprised by the diseases that you've researched, the stigma that surrounds so many diseases then and even now?
Well, certainly people were stigmatized for having plague or typhoid fever or pellagra, partly because it was not understood how they got it and whether they were contagious, and if they were, how they were contagious. So everybody else is worried about catching it, and that's what creates the stigma. When more information is learned and people understand how these diseases get spread, it helps to take away the stigma, because then you understand. For example, with plague, they thought this is something with the Chinese. But then after the San Francisco earthquake, plague returned to San Francisco, but it did not strike Chinatown, which had, you know, a lot had been destroyed. It struck everybody, you know, all races in the city. And that made people wake up and say, well, this isn't something just Chinese can get.
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad we've become a little bit more enlightened about some of these things. We are almost out of time. A new book coming out sometime in the next couple of years?
I am working on another book right now.
Okay.
Yes, and not to go into too many details, but in writing these books, I've became very interested in how people can become gullible and jump to conclusions, and my next book's going to deal with that idea.
Oh, great, great. Contact information that you can give people?
They can go on to my website, gailjarrow.com, and I'm on Facebook and Twitter.
Okay. Well, Gail Jarrow, thank you so much for joining us. Again, the book is called Bubonic Panic: When Plague Invaded America. Thank you so much for sharing this.
Thank you for having me on.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.